Well, good morning and welcome to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we are certainly glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. Well, from time to time here on the program, we're fortunate that we have writers as our guests. The Department of English and sometimes other units bring writers to the campus so that people can meet them, hear them, so that young writers here on the campus will have the opportunity to talk with them. And we're very pleased to have a writer with us this morning who is here visiting the campus, sponsored by the Creative Writing Program within the Department of English. And this is Xu Shi. She is one of Hong Kong's leading English language writers. She's produced 6 books of fiction and essays, also has edited several anthologies of Hong Kong writing, and she has a new book that's actually a non-fiction work that is about the place where she was born and grew up and still continues to spend time, that is Hong Kong. The title of the book is Evanescent Isles from My City Village, and it is published by the Hong Kong University Press. She will be doing a reading at the university bookstore this afternoon, and so anyone who is interested in meeting her and hearing from her should feel welcome there. And, of course, you can go and head out to the bookstore or wherever you buy your books and look for her book. She's authored a number of things and received some awards for her work. She was on the short list for the 2007 Man Asian Literary Prize. One of her stories also appeared in the O. Henry Short Story Anthology. She right now, at the moment, is spending the spring semester at the University of Iowa there in their nonfiction writing program. Otherwise, she does spend time various other places. She's on the prose faculty of the Vermont College of Fine Arts and spends time around the world talking and writing and living, and we're really pleased that she could be here to spend some time talking with us. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Well, good morning. Thank you for having me here.
I'm interested in having you talk about how it is that you started writing, and particularly how it is that you started to write in English.
Well, a lot of that had to do with the fact that my parents were sort of immigrants to Hong Kong. They're Chinese-Indonesian, and they both arrived in Hong Kong separately after the war and got married and raised a family there. But as a result, they were not like most of the other Chinese population there. They were not Cantonese speakers, which is the primary dialect in Hong Kong. Mm-hmm. Of course, back then, it was a British colony, so my education was all in English. And my parents, because they came from this of mixed linguistic background, they decided, well, our kids really should speak English. So they kind of gave us English as a first language. But of course, growing up in Hong Kong, Cantonese almost became a second language as well. But it was funny because I often say I had no native language, no mother tongue, because both languages were languages that were foreign to my family. My parents were Javanese speakers, which is a dialect of Indonesian. But Indonesian as a language wasn't very useful in Hong Kong, so that's why English sort of became the language. Mm. But as far as how I started writing, it was just something I did. I was sort of 9 or 10, and I discovered I really liked it at school. And I woke up literally one morning at 4 o'clock in the morning, and we were living in the middle of the city facing the Hong Kong Harbor. And so I sort of crept downstairs. We lived in a duplex apartment, and I just thought, this is quiet. This is nice. Hong Kong's a really noisy place. This is the one time it's quiet. And I sat down and I wrote an essay, and then I sent it off to the local paper, and they published it. And this was like, oh my God, you know, I can actually have my stuff out there. And that was the beginning of it. And I've literally never stopped. It sort of began there and just kept going.
Yeah. This book is, I think, is it something, a departure for your writing in the sense that it is nonfiction?
It is a departure. My last book was a collection of essays and stories, but it was kind of a compilation of stuff that had already been published, which is a little bit different. And after that came up, as I'm really, you know, that's how I began. I wrote novels, I wrote stories, and I still write novels and stories. But I had gotten interested in the idea of the essay because I was seeing things that wanted to be said in fact as opposed to in fiction. And the essay just seemed like the natural form. And once I started writing a couple of them, without even thinking about a book at the time, the way I was writing fiction, which is just kind of like nobody's asked you for this, just write it. Whereas all the nonfiction I'd done before, it was some editor that said, will you give us a piece on? That's when I began to understand there is a way of expressing yourself in creatively in an essay that is pretty much the way you do it in fiction, which is that you just want to write about this, yeah, not because some editor wants a piece. And that's how it began.
Well, in some of the things that I've read, particularly about this book, you seemed to be saying that you weren't that perhaps the thing that attracted you to fiction writing was that it was something where you could give full rein to your imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And that when you're writing nonfiction, well, that's supposed to be real. It's supposed to be real.
Uh-huh.
And I suppose each of those forms has some appeal, but each has maybe also some restrictions.
Yes, it does. Yeah. I found, I always thought there was no restriction in fiction. And then I began to find that there were. There were things in my life that I wanted to sort of turn into fiction which wouldn't happen in fiction. I would write entire stories and throw them away. It was kind of like, no, this is something I want to talk about the way it really was, the way it really happened. And a lot of it had to do with the way I saw my city, the kind of family background I came from, how I grew up in a colonial society, and how that sort of made us a very postmodern kind of city in a way. We were a very unusual place politically and historically. And once we're part of China now, but yet we're not. We're not like the rest of China. Anybody who visits Hong Kong and then visits China goes, oh my God, it's two different kind of places, and it's the same country. It's sort of like New York City and the rest of America. It's not quite the same. Yeah.
Well, that I think for you, place, and this place in particular, mm-hmm, has always been very important in your writing.
It sort of happened accidentally. When I was a kid, I wrote about everything outside of Hong Kong. My imagination was fired by everything I read in English, and I was a student of English literature, which of course happened in like little country villages in England or in sort of the wide open spaces of America, or like Huck Finn, on the Mississippi. And this is long before I saw the U.S. So I always wanted to escape. So a lot of my early writing was sort of escapist. But then part of the thing is I actually like realistic fiction. I like a fiction of today and sort of social commentary and where we are now. But I couldn't do it about the U.S. or about England or about these places that I, quote-unquote, didn't belong to. And sort of almost reluctantly, I found myself setting stories and setting things in Hong Kong or using that Hong Kong environment and place. And before I knew it, suddenly I started wanting to learn more about my own city, especially once I came to this country. It's sort of like you don't miss it when you're there, but once you go away, it's like, oh my God, all these things that people want to know about, I think maybe I better find out.
Yeah.
And so suddenly I became sort of an archivist and sort of archaeologist of my own city.
Just to reintroduce again, our guest this morning is Xu Shi. She is one of Hong Kong's leading English language writers. She was born there and did a lot of her growing up there. Also has lived in the United States and other places as well, and has taught in a variety of places, including here at the United States at the Vermont College of Fine Arts. Right at the moment, she is spending time at Iowa, University of Iowa, teaching nonfiction writing. She's here visiting the campus. The folks in the English department have brought her here. She's going to be doing a reading this afternoon at the Illini Union Bookstore, and is the author of a number of books, including a new one that we're here talking about, Evanescent Isles from My City Village. This is a nonfiction work that is partly memoir, but it's also an exploration of the city where she grew up and continues to spend time exploring it, and perhaps what makes it special and different from other places, maybe also what makes it a kind of archetypal city of the 21st century, very, very much a global city.
It is very global and always was. And my particular upbringing was rather global because my father and mother being from Indonesia, that created a sort of my sense that there was the rest of Asia. Hmm. And then my father was a businessman he went to Japan a lot. So he introduced the idea that, Japan is another culture that we can sort of think about as part of our lives. And we always had visitors of all kinds of nationalities in our home. So to me, it was a very global place. And I also lived in the middle of the city where all the tourists came. So, and during the Vietnam War, all the battleships would be anchored right in the harbor, right in front of me. And I'd see all these, like, American sailors all over the place. And I was kind of like, there's this other world out there. So I was always very conscious of the other world out there. And my desire as a kid was like, I got to get out of this place and go to that rest of the world.
Well, that you were talking about how in your writing when you were a girl that it was about escape because you were writing about all these other places. So that when for the first time you came to go to school in the United States, for you, was that an escape?
In a way, yeah, I couldn't wait to get to the U.S. And it was tough getting here in a way because my father was actually doing very well when I was younger, but then his business had a huge setback and it never sort of got back to the state it was in previously. So even being able to go to college was difficult. But I happened to find a scholarship for foreign students at a SUNY, and that's why I wound up there. And I had an aunt who could float my plane ticket. And so it was like on a wing and a prayer, I kind of got to America. But yeah, it was something I dreamed about as a kid. Because I never felt I quite belonged in Hong Kong. We were Indonesian citizens. I spoke English well, but I could also speak Cantonese. I was sort of Chinese, but I was part Indonesian. So I felt like, you know, I don't really fit here. Then I get to America and I realize, you know, there are like no Asians in this place. Especially in the tiny town I was in, and I suddenly realized you're a minority everywhere, and that was a very interesting sort of discovery for me.
Well, and does that shape the way you think of yourself? And does it also make it difficult for you to say there's some place that's my home?
It is, and this is why I live in more than one place. I found New York City eventually, which seems like a natural place for somebody like myself. Very urban sort of place. But I also love the countryside, but I'm not really a country girl, but I do have a home in the country in New Zealand. And my home in the U.S. is also in the country in northern New York State. And part of the attraction of that is that it's so much the opposite of the city. And it's a place for a writer, it's quiet, you know, that nothing happens. Well, a lot happens in the country, usually animal life, but, you know, there's not so much going on that you have to worry about, you know, being out there. Whereas in the city, you always feel like you're missing something if you're not out there. So I have this incredible contrast in my life now, sort of the real quiet of one place and the city that I can sort of investigate and be a part of as well.
Well, I would certainly think a place like Hong Kong would be one. Well, you said it yourself, really, would be one of the noisiest places, the busiest places. It's the concentration of people in a very small area. There are lots and lots of people there in Hong Kong that I would think that it was always sort of vibrant and pulsing and the very much the opposite from a quiet little house in upstate New York.
Yes, it is, because actually we've just hit 7 million officially as a population figure. And it's a tiny little space. There are all these islands around us, but a lot of them are actually very small and uninhabited. So most of the people live in the concentrated area of the main island and the peninsula that's connected to the mainland. And then we have the harbor in between. And we have an airport on another island, which is a fairly large island, which is actually larger than the main island. But that's where our airport is. And so, I mean, we don't have a lot of space, so to speak, and everything's sort of concentrated. And then I go to a country like New Zealand where the total population is 4 million. And I look around and I think, my God, there's no people here, you know. So, yes, and it's so noisy in Hong Kong. Even as a child when it was, in the 60s, it was less populated. 4 in the morning when I woke up, I could hear people. I lived on the 17th floor. I could hear people in the streets below speaking. I could hear the noise of cars going by, even at 4 in the morning. It never completely shuts down. At least a taxi or a bus or something, maybe not a private car. And I was right in front of the railroad at the time, too. So,
Well, maybe this would be a good time for me to ask you if you would read something from Evanescent Isles. Maybe there is something that conveys something of the feeling of the place?
I'm not sure which section to read in that case then, because it is a noisy place.
Whichever one you were thinking about doing, I'm sure would be fine.
Okay. Well, I thought I'm staying with some friends here, actually my host who helped bring me to the University of Illinois, and he has a 14-year-old daughter there, so I thought I'd read my 14-year-old story
okay,
here. Because I was thinking of Hannah, my host's daughter, who is just 14. And this is being 14 in Hong Kong in the 1960s and loving literature and wanting to be a writer, but all the other things that go on in life as well. And the title, I'll just read the opening of the essay, is Et tu, mon père. So there I was, 14, full of Shakespeare and Dickens and Keats, which was all we knew of English literature as Form 3 came to an end, although what continued to puzzle me was the coefficient of heat, which I still hadn't comprehended in physics or the ABC of algebra, which I would not truly comprehend for at least 2 more years, just in time for school certificate math, which got me a pass in the public exam, but only just. My girlfriends and I were addicted to personality books, and we assiduously filled in each other's notebooks with data and secrets during, between, and after classes. Mine was comprehensive, demanding information worthy of a database long before students used laptops as notebooks or cell phones as ears. Once past the more mundane details, favorite colors, flowers, movies, TV shows, actors, actresses, singers, et al., there followed the vital stats. First love, first boyfriend or girlfriend, we allowed for lesbian secrets in our all-girls school, first kiss. Vital stats were answered in code for which only your best friend had the key, but to which everyone else could guess at. 46, also known as TR, was my first love, a Eurasian boy from a neighborhood boys' school I had danced with once at a party. 4 letters in his first name, 6 in his last. Such foolish things absorbed our days of hormones and innocence as summer approached, another school year ending. Vacation was time to dream, to write stories for my eyes alone, to read the optional book list Mrs. Liao, our English teacher, had given us. I had my public library card and was poised to start with Richardson's Pamela, the literary if dreary answer to hormones and innocence and the safeguarding of a maiden's virtue, although it was vice, not virtue, that tempted your soul, forcing new definitions of right and wrong. Pamela, I decided that summer, was a fool and wrong, dead wrong. Her saving grace was to provide the English novel an epistolary form. The end of Form 3, however, signaled another milestone for your future, which, in my mother's eyes, was the all-important only thing that mattered. By some peculiar metaphoric assignation, we were streamed into science, arts, and domestic science based on our grades and talents. The syllabus from then on was a tailored cram towards the 9 subjects for your school certificate public exams at the end of Form 5. This sounds democratic enough, but in the Hong Kong school system of the 1960s and even today, we know democracy is illusory at best. The system was all about class. If not your present social class, then undoubtedly your future one, unless, of course, your family was already rich and would continue to be, in which case you could fail school cert and life would still be a hotbed of roses. If you wanted to go to university, meaning, of course, if you wanted a shot at an upper-class life, you had to get into science or arts. Domestic science girls were curiously self-negating. Not as clever as you, did say to those of us whose marks streamed us into A, arts, or B, science classes in Form 4. In a world of equals, some will always be more equal than others, although even then, I suspected this way of looking at the world was dead wrong. The future vindicated because plenty of the not-as-clever girls went on to universities, good careers, excellent lives. Even then I knew life is not only about 100 in biology, personality counted too.
That's Xu Shi reading from her most recently published book. It's a collection of essays, partly memoir, an exploration of what life is like in the city where she was born and grew up, Hong Kong. Evanescent Isles from My City Village, that's the title of the book. It's published by the Hong Kong University Press. She's here visiting the campus. Her visit's sponsored by the Department of English Creative Writing Program, and she will be reading from this book, her new book, Evanescent Isles, at the Illini Union Bookstore in the Author's Corner this afternoon at 4:30. So anyone who is interested in stopping by should feel welcome. It's an event sponsored by the Carr Reading Series. We've been lucky enough to have a lot of writers who've been here as part of this series on our program, and glad to have her here as well. She's spending the spring semester at the University of Iowa in their nonfiction writing program. She has authored a number of books. She's written novels, 6 books of fiction and essays, including the book Overleaf Hong Kong, Stories and Essays of the Chinese Overseas, the novel Unwalled City. She's also on the prose faculty at Vermont College of Fine Arts and teaches writing internationally various places and spends some of her time in the United States living in New York and sometimes still living in Hong Kong and sometime in New Zealand. You must spend a lot of time on airplanes.
Yes, I do. Actually, I worked in an airline when I was young. When I first came out of college, I ended up working at Cathay Pacific Airways, which is Hong Kong's airline pretty much. And at that time, it was a small airline, and now it's this huge major airline. And it just gave me a taste for how you could travel all over the place, because back then it was quite easy to use sort of standby tickets and get on planes and fly all over the world. And it was a lot of fun.
Hmm. So what did your parents want you to be?
Well, they didn't exactly say be a writer. You know, in fact, you know, the essay I just read from, I ended up as a science student because my mother insisted I do that. And I was actually much more, you know, inclined to the arts. And she actually, you know, the essay is all about how I had to switch over to the science class. And this is very Hong Kong. I mean, sort of the classic stereotype model of the Chinese student in America is always some science geek who's like really good at math, you know. And there isn't a lot of room because, you know, they figure if you do the sciences, you can go into, you can become a doctor or you can become, you can go into business. Certainly that was the kind of career you were expected to do, or if you really had to do the arts, then go teach. And I didn't really want to be a teacher. In fact, I didn't teach for most of my life. I've only been teaching for the past 6 years. So it felt like, you know, you had to kind of go into sort of the commercial world, or if you didn't become like a doctor. And I wasn't going to become a doctor, so I ended up in the commercial world.
Yeah.
And that was okay. And it was a long time before my, you know, as long as the writing was just kind of like, oh, she does that on the side. We don't talk about that.
Yeah. Well, and then you, so there was this, so you came to the United States and were at CINE. Then you worked in the business world for a while. Mm-hmm. Then what was it that influenced this decision then to come back and to work on your MFA?
Writing.
And writing.
Well, I had sort of hit a point. I was at this airline and it was the 70s and a time when if you were to sort of further your career in corporate life, an MBA was a really good thing to do. And everybody was talking about sort of the Harvard MBA and that method, and that was the thing to do. But at that time, there were not a lot of MBAs yet coming back to Hong Kong, although, of course, that's changed. So I was kind of like, MBA, but, you know, in my spare time, I'm writing this novel. So I did what anybody does when they don't know what to do. You quit your job. And I took off for a year and I tramped around Europe with the last of my free tickets, you know. And I thought, let me see if I can figure out how to do this. And in an earlier trip in Greece, I met a writer from one of the universities in Arizona who told me about MFA programs. I had never heard of one. I had taken one creative writing course as an undergraduate. I didn't even know that you could do this for real. There were no writing programs in Hong Kong at all. There was, you know, I didn't know anything about the universities there, but basically they taught English literature if you were in English. And I knew I didn't want to be an academic because I had actually applied to do a PhD at one point, and I thought, no, I can't do this, you know. And I'm really eternally grateful I didn't do it. So it was kind of like when he told me about that, I thought, maybe that's something I could think about. And I could sell the idea to my parents because it's like, it's graduate school. I'll have a master's degree. And then I can come back to Hong Kong. Maybe I could teach English. And so that was okay.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, if I do an MBA, my life is set and I will forever do this corporate life. And are you going to listen to what makes money and a living? Because you know you can make a living no matter what. Or are you going to do what, you know, you really think you care about? And I chose the latter.
And that was writing for you. That was really what
writing,
you care about.
Yeah.
In this book, there's a wonderful little story right at the very beginning,
mm-hmm.
where you talk about the fact that in Hong Kong, if you go to the subway. Some people may have had the same experience if they're in England. You're cautioned that there's a space between the platform and the train.
Right.
So they're saying, mind the gap. That's what they say.
Mind the gap, yes.
Be careful. Don't trip. Don't fall on this when you're getting on and off the train. And so that's okay. But the wonderful thing here that you talk about is that there also is a version of this caution that's delivered in Cantonese. Mm-hmm. And the translation is something wonderful. and you use that as a jumping off point. So uh-huh. How do they say that in Cantonese?
请小心月台，知空隙。
And how would you render that in English?
I said it was, please mind the gap, the crack in space between the train and the platform. And that's a kind of... I take a lot of liberties with that translation because that's not – it's – you can – the word quick, which actually is just translated as gap in contemporary Chinese, does have another sort of geographical meaning of a crack as well. And so after I did this, you know, I got interested in this word, so I went and looked up its etymology and everything. Then I went to somebody who's like a major translator in Hong Kong, and she teaches in the translation department in one of the universities. And I said – what would you say if I told you this is how I translated? And she looked at it and she started smiling and she said, it works. You know? And I thought, okay, she's blessed it. It's all right. It's, you know, I can do this. You know?
The crack in space. So that you take that as a jumping off point to think about and talk about Hong Kong.
Yes.
And about the relationship, I guess, between that and any place else or between that and the mainland.
Mm-hmm.
What are the various sorts of meanings, levels of meanings you can attach to crack there? Yeah.
It's almost like we were this accident. The earth cracked open and suddenly there was Hong Kong. Because, I mean, we were kind of a British invention. The Hong Kong that China was forced to give away to Britain, and which the Britain annexed, was this sort of barren isles. And the founder, Eliot, who actually sort of got this for Britain, was very much reviled for it. He was told, you know, you idiot, why on earth did you take this useless place, you know? But he saw it, it had a very deep harbor, so he saw it as a port that could be really something special. He saw it as a very strategic location, and he was right. But we don't think of him as right. You know, China thought, you know, this is this horrible invader from Britain, and Britain thought this is this fool we sent out there who did this, you know. So we were kind of like this accident, this crack that, you know, sort of jump over it, don't think about it. It's the kind of crack in a sidewalk where the grass grows through, you know. Mm-hmm. Somehow life still comes up despite the fact that it shouldn't in a place like this. And of course, you know, we see where Hong Kong is today. It's this incredibly huge modern city, but we never would have thought that's what it was if you were looking at it in sort of 1840, you know.
Yeah, so. Well, clearly at the point where this was, it was 1997.
Yes.
When the quote-unquote handover, when it went from being a British colony back to being a part of China. Mm-hmm. I know that people in Hong Kong were very concerned about how life in Hong Kong might change with that change. Has the change in Hong Kong been significant?
It's probably more significant than we are willing to say it is or acknowledge it is. Because on the face of things, it hasn't changed. We still have our own government. We have our own set of laws. We have our own stock market, even our own currency. We make a lot of decisions for ourselves. We don't make sort of foreign relations decisions, but we never did. We have a vote of sorts that is not really true democracy. But again, that's something we never had. So on the face of things, things haven't changed that much. Instead of being a colony of Britain, and this is sort of heresy, but I still say it, we're now a colony of China. And so to a Hong Kong person, it's kind of like, well, life goes on, doesn't it? You know, we have much more freedom of speech than in China. We're not going to get thrown into jail if we, you know, say something. We can protest. And the Falun Gong, for example, can protest in Hong Kong, but not in China. So in some ways, we still feel like we used to. But there are some definite changes coming down the pike. For one thing, we now have three official languages, English, Cantonese, and Putonghua, or Mandarin. And that's probably one of the more significant changes, because Cantonese is very rooted as a language in Hong Kong. The population is still about 94-95% Chinese, and it's mainly Cantonese or Southern Chinese. But on the mainland, Mandarin is very much the official language. And you can see anybody who comes from the upper classes in Hong Kong, the two languages they want their children to be truly, you know, fluent and articulate in are English and Mandarin. All the international schools teach Mandarin. And so anybody with any money or, you know, who wants their child to have, like, you know, a shot at the future sends their kids to the international schools. And there's something fundamentally wrong. It's like saying, you know, the Hong Kong that we are and were, well, that's not good enough. So, I mean, and that's raising the hackles for a lot of people in Hong Kong who feel like, you know, we have an identity as Hong Kong people, but that identity is slowly getting subsumed to a larger Chinese identity. And unlike the sort of British and Hong Kong Chinese question, Britain was so clearly an outsider, so clearly the colonial power. And of course, we think about colonization in a different sort of way. But there is a very sort of, it's a real conflict for Chinese in Hong Kong, because on the one hand, of course, we're Chinese. We're proud to be Chinese. We should take pride in the fact that China got the Olympics, and Hong Kong was incredibly proud when China got the Olympics. But at the same time, what about this Hong Kong identity? What about our own history? What about this part of us that became very real, that created John Woo movies, that created, you know, Wong Kar-wai's movies, that created the great fashion industry that comes out of Hong Kong, that created so much that Hong Kong is, this amazing sort of free market system that we have, this laissez-faire market system, with a very good social services system, where we care about our elderly, our sick. You know, we don't just, like, leave them to die somewhere, you know? And we have a wonderful medical system in Hong Kong. All of these things were built under a British colonial era, as well as a good public housing system. And are we not to take pride in this? Are we not to sort of say that this means something? So it is a sort of conflict for the Hong Kong sort of identity. I think the identity is the thing that is most at risk at the moment.
Yeah. Well, and how would you, I wonder how would you think about the I sort of have this feeling that as far as the rest of the world was concerned, when the handover happened, that they saw, you know, what was most important to a lot of Hong Kong people was that the thriving commercial spirit of the place didn't change, and that the people there, as long as they could keep making money, they didn't care. You know, it could be the British, could be the Chinese, that it didn't matter. Mm-hmm. That what really matters is making money. Mm-hmm. And as long as you can do that, you know, who's ever is nominally in charge, that doesn't matter.
Well, that's only partially true, because Hong Kong in the interim, you know, any sort of culture where you have a bourgeoisie, then the arts happen. Then things like who are we becomes a question that you seriously explore. Then your children don't all have to be doctors, lawyers, Indian chief. They can also go and be dancers, artists, filmmakers, painters, writers. And we're seeing more of that now. The new generation isn't just about money. Yes, they will make a living. They'll go to the right universities, etc. But they also care about, well, what happens to people? They care about human rights, for example. They care about the green world. How do we install or instill the idea of environmentalism among our young? And this is something that China is at a different stage, because, of course, the country was a lot poorer. So we have this sort of disconnect. There is a difference. And an interesting thing has happened, though. Hong Kong culture, such as it is, has been sort of exported to places like Vancouver and to all other parts of the world as well. You see sort of pockets of this Hong Kong around the place. I am startled now. And in fact, even here at the University of Illinois, there are students who are children of Hong Kong people who would be my generation, who are now doing things like taking MFAs in writing. And I've run across them in Iowa as well and elsewhere. And this to me is interesting, not to mention the ones who go on and study music or go to, you know, do other things. Yeah. And once this would have been different. And This is the thing that I think the rest of the world doesn't see. They don't see a society that has a culture, that has its own kind of sense of self, which is more than just money-making. And quite often, and it's sort of a cliche, you have sort of the foreign banker coming in and saying, well, Hong Kong people, all they care about is making money. Yeah, maybe in 1955 or something, not anymore. Mm-hmm. It's more than that. And I think that that's what I think Hong Kong people, who are largely middle class, basically, feel, that, oh, we're going to lose that. And then it becomes a question of, well, where do you take it? Because you care about this.
Yeah. So. You know, one of the things in one of the interviews I read, I thought it was interesting. You, at one point, you were talking about the impact of American culture, the undeniable impact of American culture around the world.
Yeah.
But one of the things that really struck me was that you said that it actually, in fact, now there are more Americans living in Hong Kong than there are British.
Yeah, in fact, that was a startling thing to me. When I had been away from Hong Kong, at least not living there, and I went back to work in Hong Kong in 1992. When I arrived, the actual number of Americans were more than British. And at this point in time, that's still true. And I'm thinking, well, where did all the British go? And I guess what was interesting, what happened was a lot of people had immigrated to Canada. So we also had not just Americans, but Canadians as well. Mm-hmm. And so that contributed to a kind of North American culture in Hong Kong among the young. And the fact that, you know, in schools, for example, even though they may still spell British, they actually speak more North American, something that is a little bit more of a global kind of English. And it's not at all important to try to acquire a British accent anymore, you know, whereas once the sort of upper class in Hong Kong, certainly a civil servants of a certain age all speak with a certain kind of British accent still. Mm. Yeah.
Well, you've certainly talked about how the influence of the popular culture of Hong Kong around the world just and in mm-hmm. film is only one example
area,
of that
yeah.
thing, one area of that thing. Are there other ways that you think that Hong Kong has been influenced in important ways by popular culture of America?
Oh, yes, certainly film. I mean, film is one of the biggest pop culture sort of exports, as well as music. Anytime I'm back in Hong Kong, it's kind of like, well, oh, let's see, who's coming now? The Spice Girls, the Pussycat Dolls, you know, what, you know? Madonna. Certainly a lot of American pop icons make it, you know, into Hong Kong. Well, British as well, European as well. It's not just American. But American culture is so large, it you can't escape it. Disneyland is something that kids aspire to go to because we have a Disneyland in Hong Kong now, you know. It seems almost horrifying to think that, you know, there are Chinese kids in Hong Kong growing up today who are learning about Fa Mulan, the warrior maiden, through
the Disney version.
Oh.
So. We have about 10, a little bit more than that, 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. I should introduce again our guest, Xu Shi. She's one of Hong Kong's leading English language writers, has produced 6 books of fiction and essays. She has been a visiting writer at the University of Iowa. In fact, she's there now this semester at the University of Iowa teaching in their nonfiction program. She's on the prose faculty at Vermont College of Fine Arts in their MFA writing program. She has also taught other places around the world. And does indeed continue to live sometime in Hong Kong, sometime in New York, sometime in New Zealand. Her most recent book is Evanescent Isles. It's a collection of essays about Hong Kong. It's published by the Hong Kong University Press. She's here visiting the campus and will give a reading at 4:30 this afternoon at the Author's Corner of the Illini Union Bookstore. So anyone who is interested should stop by. And that way you can, if you'd like to have a copy of Evanescent Isles, which actually is not all that easy to find, you can stop by and do that. Meet her as well. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers if somebody wanted to call in. Would you like to read something else, maybe, from the book?
Sure. I could try to find something else that might be a little different than the... Well, maybe there is one section in the book which are supposed to be sort of these editorials. They're very short little pieces, and I dated them. Like, one was in... There are only 4 of them, in 02, 04, 05, and then in 07. And they're sort of written by this cranky Hong Kong person who uses the pen name Longhei, meaning dragon's breath. And, well, I'll just read you the notes by the author, which is that these post-97 op-eds are by a bilingual Cantonese-English native of Hong Kong. International writers who do not embrace either the language or ambivalence of the majority opine and emote on developments in the city till their keyboards are worn, certain their words define a superior moral stance. Longhei, whose pen name means dragon's breath, has never been entirely sure that words, or rather keystrokes, should ever carry such weight. Likewise, Longhei is uncertain whether pen names, however pseudonymous, do in fact conceal an author's identity. And maybe I'll just read a little bit from the one from May 2004, which says, "Democracy? But sweetie, wouldn't you rather go shopping? Perhaps we need a truth universally acknowledged that a people long denied democracy must be ill-equipped for its arrival. This seems to be the case today for our citizenry, despite the basic law and a colonial history of civil rights and Western-style freedoms. As a native of the city, I cannot help but wonder if something went awry, or if, in fact, it was history that was awry. Perhaps this is the time to reflect in our present designation as an SAR, an acronym to replace the BCC, British Crown Colony. After all, this one country, two systems tag for our peculiar political entity supposedly guarantees us autonomy and self-governance for 50 years after the handover to the motherland. What can we say of democracy in Hong Kong? It has now been 7 years since the change, yet every time we scratch that itch, a sore erupts rather than the hoped-for relief. Under British rule, we the people were almost proud to be apolitical. In fact, weren't we the pioneer people back then who kept our heads down, worked hard, and valued economic growth above and beyond all else? Oh, there was that scuffle in 66-67 that vaguely resembled a bid for democracy, but the protest, you recall, was against the British. The West aided and abetted happily enough during China's isolationist years and feasted on Hong Kong's prosperity without democracy. By the early 90s, North Americans, yes, we also mean you, Canadians, outnumbered British nationals in the fragrant harbour, these being mostly finance and multinational executives, professionals or academics, and their entourages, as well the passport migrants whose return contributed to these numbers. For 30-something years before the handover, we were the party city for global capitalism. Yes, we also mean foreign professionals and academics who first helped establish and later lusted after the pig fat fees and salaries in the government and universities. As the long march faded in China's collective memory, and to get rich became glorious a la Deng Xiaoping, even the elite comrades ventured south to our shores, that neverland for lost boys and girls. Did it feel like democracy then?"
Again, that's Xu Xi, you're reading from her new collection of essays about Hong Kong, Evanescent Isles, From My City Village. It is published by the Hong Kong University Press. And I wonder how you feel about attempts to classify you and your writing. In the sense, I guess I would think when people hear you're an Asian writer, they might think one thing. When they hear that you're a Chinese writer, they might think one thing. Right. When they hear that you're an Asian woman writer, they might think one thing, and then also I'm not exactly quite sure what to make of this Asian writer writing in English sort of thing,
yeah.
Which is I guess as I understand it, to be sort of a smallish club of, mm-hmm. of Asian writers, yeah. writing in English,
uh-huh. a growing one probably.
Do you well and no doubt, I guess do you feel that is somehow a problem for you in how people might think about you in your writing?
Well. For a long time, I kind of didn't know how to talk about my own sort of writer identity. And I would at some points of default to the standard, oh, I'm just a writer and I don't care about all that stuff. But that's actually not true, because people do sort of read your work with different sort of perspectives in mind. Certainly, there have been sort of in some of the women as a woman writer and some of the sort of feminist issues that have come up in my earlier work, or writing about sex, for example, especially in sort of a Chinese culture where to talk about sex is like a no-no, you know? And then also the sort of Asian or Asian hyphen American, because I am an American citizen now, or whether it's like an Asian in English. I these days sort of say, well, I write about Hong Kong. You know? I'm a Hong Kong writer. And I'm beginning to think it doesn't matter what that means, because Hong Kong, well, what do you think Hong Kong is, you know? And then it begins from there. Because there are Hong Kong people all over the world. I mean, I've written about Hong Kong people in Massachusetts and in Greece. And I've also written about Asians generally, sort of using my sort of Chinese-Indonesian background. So it's sort of a mixed kind of Asian heritage. And after a while, it's sort of like I write about the world as I see it, the modern world. And I happen to have come from a certain corner of it, which is called Hong Kong. It's a unusually cosmopolitan corner, but nonetheless, I think it has something to say about postmodernism, the 21st century, where we're headed. Because in a way, Hong Kong was forced to be kind of postmodern even before the term happened, you know, since we were sort of inventing it as we went along. And I think that that's how I think about my writing now, that I just look at the kind of world that I happen to have inhabited while I was here on this earth, and that's what I write about. Yeah. And it happens to be a little Hong Kong, a little U.S., a little New York, a little, you know, the rest of the world.
Well, it seems to me that, you know, Hong Kong really does, you really can use the melting pot analogy, I think. Or do you think that you would say,
not really. Not ethnically, really. It's not. In some ways, it has a very strong Chinese, and I'm going to qualify that as Cantonese identity, in terms of its language, culturally, its social mores, because, you know, there was no communism in Hong Kong. So we didn't get all that communist ideology. So what retained was the Confucian Chinese doctrine. If there is a religion and there is no sort of state religion in Hong Kong, so to speak, it actually comes out of Confucianism, which is a sort of sense of order and propriety and what you do in the family and respect for your ancestors, etc. And that's still very prevalent in Hong Kong. We have freedom of religion, so you can be Buddhist or Catholic. It doesn't matter, you know. But what is at its cultural root is still the classical Chinese culture, not the China culture that has evolved under 50 years of, you know, first Mao and then, you know, the Communist Party. So it's a very different kind of ethos.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess I was thinking of it in terms of, you know, willingness to embrace other...
The world,
The world. Although it is interesting that I think you, at one point when you you were also... And one of the things that I read talking about Hong Kong, you said now going back there now, you said that you find the city now to be both more Chinese and more international.
It is, which is kind of interesting to me. We have a kind of like hip nightclub area that at one time, when it first opened up, everybody said, oh, that's where all the foreigners go. Well, that's just not true. You know, I mean, you see more Chinese kids there than you do anything else now. So there's kind of that internationalizing. It's like it's okay to mix, you know, with foreigners. You see a lot more intermarriages between Chinese and, you know, people of other races, something you would not have seen, you know, 30, 40 years ago, at least not readily. And now it's far more common and kids dating, you know, across races. But at the same time, there's been this embrace of Chinese culture that we kind of forgot about. It's like, you know, the Hong Kong I grew up in had a lot of street theater and street opera, and a lot of that kind of became, that's that old Chinese stuff we're not interested in. And all of a sudden now, it's become important again. Let's listen to Chinese music. Let's understand our own classical heritage. And that's a good thing. So, you know, you're sort of reinvesting in all of that cultural heritage. But at the same time, it's like, but let's not be this kind of, oh, anything foreign we don't want to know, especially if it's Western, because that would be a hard stance to take these days because so many people travel now. They have traveled outside of Hong Kong, but they come back and they bring with them what they've seen of the rest of the world. So I think that that's why it's in one way more international. On the one hand, it could be things like French food, for example, or, you know, cuisine from around the world. But on another level, it's also the culture that comes from everywhere else. And that's much more embraced.
A couple of the things that I've read, I have to ask you about this. It said that you referred to yourself as a Hong Kong astronaut. I have to know what that means.
The term astronaut grew up with all the immigration to Canada for passport immigration. And what happened during the 80s especially, you had a lot of parents and families, you know, they wanted their kids to be born in Canada or in America, so they would sort of migrate there. But they would also keep their businesses, because that's how they were making a living, back in Hong Kong. And then the parents would be these astronauts. They would travel back and forth between the two. Yeah. And also along in the west coast of America, there were plenty of those too. And some went to Australia. And some went as far flung to places in South America or into like Europe, etc. So, but the majority were in Canada. That was probably the biggest numbers. And so the term astronaut grew up as a kind of term for this kind of existence where you land in here and then you come back and you land back there and you zip back and forth.
Yeah, okay.
And I'm sort of an astronaut, yes.
We're just about at the point that we have to finish. So many more things that I could ask, and we're almost at the point where we pretty much have to finish. Maybe just one last thing, since we've been talking a lot about Hong Kong and been talking about Evanescent Isles. Just if I said to you, you know, now you've had the opportunity, I'm sure, to experience a lot of big cities around the world, in New York and London and who knows where else. Is there something in particular that right springs to mind if I say, well, what sets Hong Kong apart from other cities?
I think it's history. Hmm. The fact that it doesn't belong, it's not a nation state, okay? So it was always part of somebody else. And yet it has this identity. I mean, Singapore, for example, which is actually smaller than us, is a nation state. We never fought for independence under the British. And we didn't object to going back to China. I mean, the media might have made it sound like, oh, this terrible thing's going to happen. But anybody in Hong Kong kind of said, no, it's not. It's going to be perfectly fine. And we all knew it was going to be perfectly fine. It is our strange political history. And it's only now being sort of really looked at in any real way. And I think that that's going to be the important thing that sets us apart.
Well, there we will have to finish up. Our guest, Xu Shi, is on the prose faculty at Vermont College of Fine Arts in their MFA writing program. She's currently a visiting writer at University of Iowa's nonfiction writing program. She's here visiting this campus. The people in the creative writing program within the English department brought her. She'll be doing a reading and signing this afternoon at 4:30 at the Illini Union Bookstore in the Author's Corner. So anyone welcome. She'll be reading from her new book, and we mentioned a couple times. It is Evanescent Isles, and it is published by the Hong Kong University Press. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you very much for having me.